The next presentation is going to be protein contact prediction from amino acid coevolution using convolutional networks for graph-valued images. And the presenter is Vladimir Golkov from Technical University of Munich.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. My co-authors and I would like to invite you to biology. Biomolecules such as proteins are the building blocks of life. They are our nanomachines in the bodies. They perform most of the functions in life. And they play a central role in most diseases. In most diseases, something happens on the protein level. In this illustration, you can see many different proteins working together to construct membranes, to sort a specific cargo there, and then this cargo gets delivered to its destination. There are 20 common amino acid types denoted by 20 letters, and a protein is a linear sequence of amino acid residues. And this linear sequence folds in 3D into a 3D structure because it folds into an energetically favorable conformation. And then this 3D structure dictates the biological function because the protein is like a nanomachine. And during this talk, your body will produce very roughly 10 to the 19 protein molecules, and even more if I exceed the time. We do protein contact prediction, which we will see in a little bit, using convolutional networks. And we use the entire detailed coevolution data, no handcrafted compression of it. The network architecture is chosen such that it fits the problem. So we choose the number of filters, the sizes of filters, according to which features are hypothetically meaningful to be learned. So this is not a trial and error choice of network architecture, but a purposeful. We think what architecture would make sense. Our results are more accurate than state of the art, and the method works 2 to 3 times faster. And we also show a formulation for the case where we have a graph in every pixel for a convolutional network. Here is a linear sequence of an amino acid. I need to look over there from time to time to check. So this is the 1D linear sequence. The amino acid residues are denoted by letters. And this is a schematic representation of the 3D structure into which it folds to assume an energetically favorable state. And the big question is how to predict the 3D structure from the 1D sequence. Furthermore, there is a simplified representation of the 3D structure as a contact map. This is a matrix that denotes which amino acid residue is in contact with which one. And here in the red circle in the 3D structure, you see the contact between two helices, and this is reflected in the contact map as a kind of checkerboard pattern. And if the contact map is known, then it can be used as a constraint to model the 3D structure. And our approach, so these are three different representations of a protein. Our approach is to predict the contact map from the sequence, and then it can be used to infer the 3D structure. And the way we do it is using hidden Markov models, we find sequences of related proteins in other organisms, so they are slightly similar, usually thousands of them. And what happens if two amino acid residues are in contact and one of them mutates, and mutations happen from time to time in nature, then the contact might become less stable, and then there is an evolutionary pressure on the other amino acid residue to mutate as well to compensate for that, so that the structure is stable again. So we can get this information from related proteins. By inverting a POTS model, we can separate the direct from the indirect evolutionary couplings between the amino acid residues, take only the direct ones, And since there are 20 amino acid types plus one character that represents insertions or deletions of amino acids, we have 21 for pairs. That's 21 by 21 coevolution values. And since it's for all pairs of positions in a protein, in the protein with length L, we get L by L by 21 by 21 data. And this can be reshaped into L by L by 441, which we will see a bit later. And then with a convolutional network, we can predict the L by L contact map. Let's talk about this convolutional network now. It is pixels to pixels, so it takes L by L by 441 coevolution data to an L by L contact map. And we choose the architecture such that it fits the problem. So our input is the coevolution of pairs of 20 amino acid types plus one gap character. For pairs, 21 squared is 441. And now we observe that amino acids can be grouped by about 10 properties. And since we deal with pairs, we square these properties, so we have about 100 categories into which amino acid pairs can be categorized. So we choose our first layer to have about 100 filters of the size 1 by 1. As a computer scientist, as I round the number 100, I get 128, so that's the number of filters in the first layer. And this allows an abstraction and compression from 441 channels to 128 channels, and allows hypothetically to learn features such as coevolution of small polar residue at position I and a large polar residue at position J. The secondary structure of the protein is its 3D local structure. So these helices, for example, of which this protein consists. And this is reflected in the contact map patterns. So for example, a contact between two helices is visible as a checkerboard pattern in the contact map, kind of. So along the first two dimensions of the data. But also the secondary structure is reflected in the amino acid types, because the amino acid types dictate the secondary structure, because it falls into an energetically favorable conformation. So the secondary structure is also reflected along the last two dimensions of the data. So all four dimensions of the data are entangled, which means we also need the neighborhood information. It will benefit us to know something about the contact neighborhood along the first two dimensions. So our next layer has 64 filters of size 7 by 7, and this allows learning features such as that I and J is a contact between a helix and I and a helix at J, and the arrangement is anti-parallel and the contact ends after J. Similar things. So 7 by 7 is a good window to capture this kind of information, and 64 is a good number. So for example, it could be a contact between a helix and a strand, and instead of anti-parallel, it could be parallel, and so forth. So for different combinations, 64 here is a nice number. And finally, the last layer has one filter, because we predict the contacts, so one channel. And the filter size is 9 by 9, so that the overall receptive window is 15 by 15. And this provides sufficient context to also capture angles between helices. We have to do zero padding, because we go pixels to pixels. The output should still be L by L. And in order to help the network to not confuse the zeros that we invent by zero padding and real zeros that represent zero coevolution, we introduce an additional channel that tells us which zeros are invented and which ones are real. We train on 231 proteins from the CASP 9 and 10 datasets, and the test set are all 89 proteins from the CASP 11 dataset. These are proteins for which the 3D structure is known, so we have a ground truth contact map on which we can learn and test. We use dropout, mean squared error, and ADAM. And here is a qualitative result, the ground truth contact map and the prediction. So the output values are continuous, and as you can see, the contacts are nicely found from only knowing the 1D sequence of the protein. We can find the 3D contacts, physical contacts, by going through the coevolution information of related proteins. And quantitatively, the precision on the entire CASP11 data, here we compare for different contact separations at different and different thresholds of the prediction values to the methods PLM-DCA, the state-of-the-art method MetaPsyCoV, and ours, which we call PLM-CONV because it uses pseudo-likelihood maximization to find the direct evolutionary couplings and the convolutional network. So in every triplet of numbers, we want to get the highest value, and we have it in almost all cases, and especially the medium and long-range contacts that are hardest to predict and most important to infer the 3D structure. We can also plot the precision for every protein. Here, each data point is a protein. On the y-axis, we have the precision of our method, and on the x-axis, the precision of other methods. So it's good to be above the diagonal, and we are in most cases. And we can also plot the precision as a function of the number of related proteins, of homologous proteins that were found. And here we also beat the other methods almost over the entire range. And now a little bonus for the people who are interested in this graph-valued pixels representation. So the coevolution values in each pixel can be considered the 21 times 21 weights of a bipartite graph. Where in the left part we have the amino acid types of position I in the protein, and in the right part in position J, and the edge weights represent the coevolution values. So the question is, how do we put these coevolution values as the features in a convolutional network in one pixel? The way that worked best for us was to maintain the identities of the amino acid types, so always maintain the same order of these values. So vectorize the biadjacency matrix. And this worked best probably because we have sufficient training data so that the network can figure out on the abstraction level that it takes over the several network layers, all different combinations that exist for different coevolution values of amino acid types. But in other cases, it might be better to sort the values or to construct a histogram or to slightly relax the identities by resorting the rows of the biadjacency matrix. And also other approaches are possible for arbitrary graphs that we have at in the pixels. So to conclude, we have a new way to handle evolutionary couplings. Using all raw values, no handcrafted compression. Maybe the take-home message is here to use all the available information in a disentangled representation so that the network can nicely deal with it and let the network learn the appropriate transformation. And our network architecture was chosen such that it fits the model. So it's a kind of a bottom-up approach. Instead of trial and error, we think what would be a nice network architecture. And then it just works. And the contact prediction is more accurate and 2 to 3 times faster than state of the art. And it's also possible to train the method on different input features for different biological questions. And we also expect an improvement when trained on a larger set of proteins. So there are many other interesting applications of machine learning in biology. This is just a little example. So join us in biology. Thank you very much.
We have 5 minutes for discussion.
Question here. To your right.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for the talk. I was wondering if you have indel mutations that alter the length of the sequences. How do you deal with that?
Thank you for the question. Yes, we do. That is the 21st kind of type of amino acid residues. So we have the 20 common types and the 21st category that accommodates insertions and deletions.
Question from your rightmost. Hi. It's a Vikram. So I really like the paper and the talk and the model. But I had a couple of questions. So there's a lot of parameters by a protein structure's viewpoint. You have 441 times 64 times something. And you only have like order 100 training graphs. So, and your evaluation on Casp11 versus Casp9, I'm pretty sure there's a fair amount of overlap in the actual proteins between the training set and the test set. Have you considered that you might be overfitting a bit?
I don't think there is an overlap in the Casp9 and 10 and 11 data sets. So here, every sample every pixel is a sample rather than the entire protein is a sample. And Martin, my co-author, who knows more about biology, has also something to say about it.
Yeah, so there's no overlap between Casp9, 10 datasets and Casp11. And that's the reason explicitly why those sets have been chosen. CASP is this big community-wide experiment in predicting protein structures. And Casp11, well, in Casp11 we knew all the structures known until then. So Casp9, Casp10. So using Casp9, Casp10 data was a fair game. And we compared with the methods that actually participated there.
We can chat offline. Sure.
Yeah,
I agree.
Thanks. And I just want to add one more thing. The comparisons there, the best method, Metapsychov, actually uses the same inference as we do. It uses way more machine learning. It uses external data, prior knowledge, and we nevertheless are better than them.
Thank you for the question. Next.
So thanks for the talk. I have another question. So you're basically doing convolutional lens on a weight matrix, right, of the graph. And my question is, how do you then order the vertices of the graphs, right? Because if you choose a different order, then you would have different filters, right?
That's right. So there are different approaches how to reorder them. We have to fix that in advance. Then when we decided it, we can train a network. And then this is the network that can deal with exactly this reordering of the graph weights.
So this ordering came from the structure of the molecule, or?
The best way that worked is to maintain the order of amino acid types, no matter what the order is, but to fix it once, and then always know the first entry represents a certain pair of amino acid types.
So, oh, okay, I see. Thanks.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could comment on why you used mean squared error for the loss?
Good question. So I'm a fan of really using a loss function that is really tailored to the problem. In this case, this is, of course, the simplest or the first choice that could be used. I think we would improve if we really think about what the evaluation method would be, what it means to have a good prediction, even if it's not exactly one or zero, but somewhere in between, what we want to get out of it. And then I think we could improve if we choose a better error function. Thank you, wherever you are.
Hi. I'm really interested by how you handcrafted the model size. And I was just wondering, did you see any evidence of it learning the 10 amino acid groups, for example, or was it just doing its own thing in the earlier features?
Could you please repeat? I didn't quite understand.
So you handcrafted the size of each individual layers in accordance to your prior beliefs on the different features within
right.
each amino acid. Did you see any evidence of that, the model learning that?
Let me say yes and no, so to speak. So we choose the network architecture so that it's hypothetically possible to learn those features. But we, of course, let it learn whatever it wants to learn. But what we still observed is, for example, that a certain type of amino acids was more strongly represented. So something like this Venn diagram that we saw, that was reflected in the statistics of the filters. But it was not super clean. So the network did whatever was optimal like jointly for all layers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. And this concludes the session. Thanks everybody for attending and see you this afternoon.